From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Friday morning when word surfaced that Assemblyman Bill Nogé had shot himself to death in a Rochester cemetery. It was, to say the least and the obvious, shocking and sad news. Nogé was running for re-election this year. We knew that Mr. Nogé was involved with a company in Cambodia that had allegedly taken $1 million from a Cambodian dentist and then folded and walked away. That was the allegation. And immediately there was speculation in some quarters about what was happening on Friday morning. Now, Nogé always denied any fraudulent behavior. After his suicide, there were questions about whether that episode in Cambodia was moving forward. But at the Democrat and Chronicle, reporters Gary Craig and Steve Orr were on a different trail. They broke the story on Friday afternoon that Nogé was facing a criminal fraud charge, but the Cambodian case had nothing to do with it. Neither was it directly related to the Rochester School's modernization project. Instead, Nogé was going to be criminally charged in what appeared to be an embezzlement case. Nogé was managing an account for a longtime friend and client, and the FBI was looking into missing money that had gone from that account to Mr. Nogé. I've asked Gary Craig and Steve Orr to come on to the program today and lay out what we do know, what we don't know, and as it happens, the Democrat and Chronicle is getting ready to formally request that the criminal complaint against Nogé be made public. For now, it's sealed and there's no guarantee that the public will get to see the details, especially with Mr. Nogé's passing. Gary Craig, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And Steve Orr, welcome to you as well.
Glad to be here.
Let's just start with what was going on Friday. You, Gary, were at work, and Steve, you were off on Friday. I know, obviously, you both ended up working. You were off on Friday?
I was cutting the grass.
You got word of this. And I don't mean to be trite, but I imagine to both of you, just like to all of us, shocking, yeah?
Oh, for sure. I mean, both Gary and I and a lot of other journalists in town knew Bill Nogé, you know, pretty well, at least on a source to reporter level. And anytime something like that happens to someone that you know and have worked with over the years, it's very much a shock.
Yeah. Gary, same?
Very much so. I did a profile on Bill back in 2003, I think it was, and spent a lot of time with him then. And I admit I hadn't really talked to him much in recent years, but yeah, it was. It's sad. It's tragic.
And the newspaper, among other local media outlets, have been reporting on what had been going on in Cambodia. And by the way, if you sort of haven't followed Bill Nogé's career, it wasn't a surprise that he was involved in any sort of an overseas outlet, because this was a guy who was very well-traveled, from doing international elections monitoring work to having friends and business ventures in other countries. I think he traveled a lot with family, went to the Harley School for a couple of years, did some travel there. So it's not a surprise that he had some interest in Cambodia, but when the media kind of thought maybe that's what a fraud charge was coming on Friday, it was not related to that. How did you guys kind of go through that process on Friday, taking what you already knew, what you might have already collected but hadn't reported publicly yet? Can you take me through your process?
Well, yeah, sure. You know, our first reports after confirming that Mr. Nogé had died were more focused on his career. We, you know, went into the archives and pulled out Gary's profile from years ago and material like that, because we didn't know at all what might have motivated him or what was going on in his life. I mean, we, as you said, had reported about several matters that he was involved in, including this Cambodian charge, which was pending in criminal court in Phnom Penh, and also his involvement in what I've called a few times a peculiar business arrangement in the school's modernization program. But we had no idea initially if either one of those had anything to do with what happened to him.
Okay.
And somewhere, to tell you the truth, I can't really reconstruct where, there were reports coming out that he was to turn himself in, which we know to be accurate, and because of the you know, whatever was going on in Cambodia. And that seemed... It didn't seem particularly logical to me, and it seemed, I think, less logical to Steve, who's followed this much more closely than I. And from there, I was actually not in the building when the news broke. I was working elsewhere. I came in and started trying to piece together what we could. After probably a few hours, we were able to get confirmation to our sourcing standards that it was related to a trust fund, that it was related to a client, and that there were these allegations of possible embezzlement. And then we sat down and had a meeting with that. And Steve, who'd done so much legwork in the back, you know, and the work that he and Megan McDermott have done with the school modernization, basically said, well, I wonder if it could be Bud DeWolf, because he knew they had this business relationship, and we were able to confirm from there that it was.
Steve, who's Bud DeWolf?
Carlton Bud DeWolf is an architect in Rochester, has been very successful, very well known for decades, done a lot of fine work locally. He was an old friend and with Bill Nojay. Bill had been served as a lawyer a number of times over the years. They'd worked together on different things. What we picked up also, in addition to verifying that Mr. Nojay had been supposed to surrender himself in federal court Friday morning, was that whatever this fraud charge was, that apparently the FBI investigation had begun looking at Bill's role in school modernization. We reported about that extensively in May. He had been involved in a company with Bud DeWolf and some other people that was seeking a contract. They were tentatively given the contract in this huge modernization program, only to have it stripped away when one of the principals in that company quit and blamed Mr. Nojay for essentially meddling in the company and making her uncomfortable. So they lost the contract. That was the end of that. But we had picked up on Friday that apparently the FBI had been looking into that. I know Bud DeWolf had told me right after our stories were published in May that the FBI had knocked on his door and had inquired about this whole modernization program company that he and Nojay were involved in. We had not reported that, but we had that knowledge. Friday, again, Gary picked up something about school modernization. I just made I won't call it a guess, an educated guess, I suppose is more accurate, that perhaps if they started with modernization, if there was a trust fund and money involved, that maybe it was money Bud DeWolf had something to do with. So I called him and he talked to me.
You called him, you got him on the phone just like that?
Yeah. And he was very, very shaken. He knew Bill Nojay really well. And furthermore, you know, was aware of, he basically told me that, yes, he had been, the FBI had determined that, allegedly anyway, that Mr. Nojay had taken money from a escrow account. It was money due Bud DeWolf for architectural work he had done in the Kingdom of Jordan, of all places. Bill had access to the account, and the money supposedly he transferred it out somewhere. FBI found out about it. They told Bud. Thought Bud was involved at first, and he convinced them he was not. And so he knew that's what Mr. Nojay was supposed to be charged with. He had been talking to the FBI all along, and he told me that. He was, open about it. He was also, as I said, very upset. I don't know that he's talked to anybody else since then. I think he, he's just kind of overwhelmed by what happened.
Sure. But, and so when he told you about what he knew, and that obviously he was upset and shaken by the sudden loss of someone he knew for many years, did he indicate to you if their relationship had frayed because of this allegation, or if it had been repaired in any way? How did he characterize
that? Well, that was one of the things that he was so upset about, is that when this was brought to, when the FBI discovered this, according to what Bud said, they must have dealt with Mr. Nojay at that time as well, and his lawyer. And so Bill apparently began trying to pay back the money. And according to Bud, he had returned most of what he had taken out of this trust fund or this escrow account, which had held apparently about $1.8 million initially. So he was making an attempt to make restitution, if that's the right word. And so I think my sense is that Mr. DeWolf felt let down by what Bill Nojay had done, but that he also, recognized that he was trying to make good and had just not done that, not been able to return all the money, and was then about to be criminally charged.
Sure, and here's one thing that I don't know, guys, and I don't know if you do. If you've got a case where people who are friends and have essentially been sort of business partners or an attorney-client relationship for many years, and it's discovered that one may be, for lack of a better word, stealing money from the others or diverting funds for his own benefit. If that's acknowledged, and if Bud DeWolf was thinking, well, at least Bill was paying it back, could that get him out of actually facing any charges, for lack of a better word.
Speaking of Mr. Nojay?
Yeah, Mr. Nojay.
I mean, my assumption is if it's theft in the beginning, even if you're paying it back, it's still theft.
Yeah.
So I don't think it changes that. I mean, it is interesting that you hear of cases like this. And I think it should be clear, and Steve knows this better than I think, that that this did not originate with complaints from Bud DeWolf, that the FBI came to him.
Yeah.
And you'll hear issues like this sometimes handled at the Attorney Grievance Committee, which is, it's basically a way to attorneys may be suspended or whatever, disbarred. But I mean, I guess from what we're hearing, can obviously be criminal. I mean, it is considered to be embezzlement. And obviously the federal prosecutors and FBI believe they had a criminal case.
Do your sources tell you there's anything else? No. That there may be, because again, you set out on Friday to kind of figure out what was actually happening. If Bill Nojay was doing court on Friday, why was that? You discovered this through your sourcing and very, very good reporting. But is there any indication there's anything else that we don't yet know or any other pending issues?
Well, there's at least one thing, but where it would lead, we don't know. And there could certainly be other things because our impression, and we certainly haven't heard this directly from the FBI, we haven't heard anything directly from them, our impression is that they had started going over Mr. Nojay's financial dealings and business dealings pretty carefully. So one other thing that they were interested in that we had a little thing in today about it, that New York Times reported it initially Friday, was in relation to Cambodia, ironically enough. The FBI this spring from the Rochester office had opened an inquiry into whether the alleged disappearance of this $1 million from the Cambodian investor constituted a crime in this country. I spoke to a lawyer that represented the woman who lost the $1 million, who's in Texas, and he said the FBI subpoenaed records from him this spring, and those records, among other things, showed that the $1 million had flowed from this woman's account in Phnom Penh here to Rochester to a Bill Nojay's lawyer trust fund, essentially, and they have no idea what happened to the money after that. So the FBI was looking into that. They have no idea where that led, if anywhere, in terms of criminal charges. This lawyer in Texas had heard nothing about any criminal case about to be brought or anything like that. But there were other people involved in that besides Mr. Nojay, so they could certainly still be looking at whether those people committed some sort of offense.
Talking to Gary Craig and Steve Orr from the Democrat and Chronicle, who broke the story on the charges that Mr. Nojay was facing when he was due to turn himself in on Friday, the morning that he died by suicide in a cemetery near the grave plot for his family. And before I move into the question on unsealing records, let me just for a moment say, think about what you're hearing from these reporters about how this story ended up being broken in the first place. You had this extraordinarily unusual and sad event with an assemblyman taking his own life just days before an election, and a lot of speculation about what the reasons might have been. And frankly, there's still speculation. Nobody knows exactly what's in his heart. I don't know if there was any other information that he left. But there was speculation about fraud charges that ended up being wrong. We might never have known about the Bud DeWolf situation if it hadn't been for the fact that we've got reporters at our local paper that have long lists of sources and long lists of beat reporting. I don't know if beat's still the right word, guys, but I'm just going to say beat and consistent reporting on consistent stories that goes out over time, that in a matter of hours, they can turn to their sources, get information, and present the right story. And here's why it matters now. Now we've got documents that may or may not be unsealed, but this was someone serving the public in a public capacity. This was someone who there were allegations of fraud, and there are discussions in Albany this year, last year, the year before, probably the coming year, about whether there should be outside income at all and what that means. I don't mean to indict the dead here, but I think that this work is so important, and the next time you hear someone trashing local papers or making fun of the dying newspaper industry, just remember this and remember why people pay for subscriptions. Okay, off my soapbox, and let me just now turn to the question on...
We appreciate your soapbox.
Now, let me just turn to the question on unsealing documents, because he didn't show up in court, because this didn't go forward, your sources tell you this complaint should exist, that there was something happening here, but... We may not ever be able to see it. What's the state of this, Gary?
Yeah, I mean, it's I did a sort of short story today about this. It is this kind of interesting legal issue because if, you know, the criminal complaint was to be unsealed in court that day. Obviously, sadly, you know, Mr. Nojay did not show up for court, so the criminal complaint was not unsealed. So there becomes this legal issue, and I've talked to a number of lawyers, and you kind of get different opinions, it seems to be a severe lack of precedence with something like this. I mean, there's others that perhaps sort of peripherally have similarities. But as to whether it should be unsealed or not, it's an interesting dilemma because the U.S. Attorney's Office can't really, at this point in time, until they have an answer, I think, acknowledge that the complaint exists, and they really haven't. So I assume what could be going on is, I think, you know, I wrote there's probably three possibilities. One, prosecutors want it unsealed and the defense doesn't. I think the lesser possibilities are both want it unsealed. I would be surprised by that, or both want it sealed. So there could be this sort of legal scuffle going on that we have no knowledge of because it's all being done in sealed papers or whatever as to whether the criminal complaint itself should even be unsealed.
Okay. And what kind of timeline are you expecting on this now?
I mean, it's I guess an educated guess just based on covering federal court a long time, but it's such unknown waters here. I would hope we would know something this week, but let's say hypothetically the magistrate judge the way federal court works is the magistrate judges alternate criminal months and the other does civil. So this criminal month would be Magistrate Judge Jonathan Feldman. And let's say this is going on where he makes a decision. Well, what I don't know is, let's say he makes a decision, the other side decides that it's an appealable decision. I don't know if the decision is public. I don't know if it's such a mystery right now that it's really hard to put a finger on. I mean, I hope by the end of this week we know something, but I don't think I can say that with really any certainty.
Okay. And I asked before the hour began if you had heard it from anybody yet in the public saying, look, this assemblyman is gone. Leave it be. There's nothing else to be gained by this. And you indicated at least to me that you haven't heard that complaint yet. You may eventually hear from some supporters or friends or family of Bill Nojay saying, why do that? So what's the answer? If that question comes, why pursue this? Gary, I'll start with you. I'd ask you both. Why pursue it?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, you touched on a little here. I mean, and again, it's I don't want to speak ill of the dead and the dead. And as I noted on Twitter, you know, the fact that somebody's criminally charged doesn't mean they did it. And the fact that somebody takes their life doesn't mean that they did what they are criminally charged for. So I just want to be very clear about that.
Absolutely.
But as you noted, I mean, Albany has sort of been a little bit of a cesspool of, you know, ethical problems over the last few years that we know about it. And I think it probably predates that well before that. And I think, you know, that this could be seen in the bigger picture of what are our state lawmakers doing, you know, sort of with business on the side, et cetera. There's obviously this public interest in it, too. And I think partly to the speculation that you know, we've talked about people are engaged in. I mean, the unsealing of the criminal complaint itself would put an end to the speculation. We would know what he was charged with. You know, again, we would know his guilt or innocence because we wouldn't get to that phase. But at least, you know, that part of the speculation would be put to rest because we would have the criminal complaint.
Okay. Steve Orr?
I can only add that, I have, as I think about it, there have been a couple of people that have emailed me with mild complaints.
Okay.
And, you know, what I told one of the guy I know that I've corresponded with for years, and he said, oh, you know, why are you beating on Mr. Nojay so quickly, you know, not even in the ground yet? And, you know, the answer I gave him was, I'm sorry. I know people probably feel that way, but he is a public official. He was a lawyer with a fiduciary duty to his clients. He's a prominent person, really, in the community, one of our really better known state legislators, just because of all that he does. I think we have a responsibility to report on allegations against him, report on his conduct, which is why we spent a lot of time earlier this year writing about things he was involved in Cambodia and with the schools. Not because we were convinced he'd done anything wrong or illegal, but because it was unusual conduct that we thought needed to be brought to light. And the same is true here.
Yeah, and the reporters mentioned earlier that when it comes to schools modernization, that Mr. Nojay was involved, and then that contractor, at least from my understanding, did not go to the group that he was involved with because there was some concern about some of the principals that Mr. Nojay was meddling. But if our listeners are hearing this saying, wait a second, that's a $1.3 billion school modernization project. He is a state assemblyman. Shouldn't there be a wall between that? The answer that I understand is that there's not a wall, that he could have very well been involved with the group legally. There's not a legal wall between that.
He insisted that he could have been. He got an opinion from the ethics body that oversees the legislature, which perhaps says something about the ethics body.
Okay.
He said it was perfectly fine.
So as far as he understood, it was cleared. As far as this board, this body decided.
The ethics commission or whatever, they told him, I mean, believe it or not, among the advice that he got was keep your name out of it publicly. Make sure nobody knows you're involved, and that way you'll be ethically protected.
Okay. Gary?
I just want to say, and Steve would know this far better than I, but my sense was too, and to the credit of Mr. Nojay, you know, the late Mr. Nojay now, is whenever Steve and or Megan contacted him with questions about his involvement in these things, he always was very upfront in answering. I mean, he never ran from the questions, was my sense, correct?
Oh, not at all. No, he was. And he defended everything he did in great detail. And in good spirit, which I appreciated then and appreciate now.
And on this program as well. He was not only a regularly routine guest, he said yes just about whenever he asked, and there were times where he would call in as a listener when he wanted to add. And then what our listeners don't know is just about every single time he was on this program, he would email me later that day saying, how do you think it went? You know, he was very curious to know what people thought. And, you know, I found that somewhat endearing about him. I enjoyed the give and take. So let me got to be quick here, but let me grab a couple of these because all of a sudden the phones blew up. Frank in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Frank.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Yep. Go ahead.
All right. I have an incident with Bill Nojay, how I met him. I'm director of Rochester's Tibetan Buddhist Center. And you might recall in 1997, sort of the whole country got aware of Tibet through two movies, Kundun by Martin Scorsese, and then 7 Years in Tibet with Brad Pitt. And coincidentally, Rochester was like on the cutting edge of this national publicity. My wife and I had been walking through the World Trade Center of all places and noticed monks of the Dalai Lama making an elaborate sand mandala, a sand painting, and we were so intrigued about how popular it seemed to be among just the passersby. So we approached the Memorial Art Gallery. Well, first we approached the Tibetan Lama, who agreed to have the head of the Nyingma, which is the ancient ones, it means the oldest sect of Tibetan Buddhism, comes from the 9th century, the head of the Nyingma come to Rochester and give the empowerment of this world peace ceremony that's associated with the construction of that mandala. And then my wife and I went to the Memorial Art Gallery, and we had gotten the information on these Dalai Lama monks, how they could do this, what it would cost, what it would take. And lo and behold, the Memorial Art Gallery went for it. And so they set up this exhibit where the exhibit was watching the monks do this, and they had a special reentry kind of ticket. So at the time, it's been surpassed since, but at the time it was the most popular exhibit the Memorial Art Gallery had ever had. And out of all this interest, this public interest, Bill Nojay approached me. He had gotten my name through some sort of newspaper article or something. And it was so fascinating to me because, one, Nojay is a Mongolian name. And the Mongolians are the same. They do the same ceremony, this Kala Chakra. It means wheel of time. It means turning the experience of time and space that we all have into a vast machine of benefit. The Tibetans do it once every 25 years, traditionally, and unusual amongst their esoteric practices. It was the only one that was done publicly for the general public. So that was happening here in Rochester, all these things. And Bill Nojay approached, and he got, I can't remember the man's name, he was a Supreme Court judge and then Monroe County executive, Jack, anyone remember?
Jack Doyle?
Jack Doyle, yeah. Mm-hmm. Bill talked Jack Doyle into declaring 1 month Tibetan Freedom Month, or Tibetan, the month of Tibet, something like that. And he flew the Tibetan flag out of the county executive building with all the other flags. And that was really remarkable because it was at that time that Kodak was, you know, negotiating with China, getting more and more involved with China. And it was very easy to annoy the Chinese in this kind of thing. Then Bill also got in contact with Frontier, and for this empowerment that we did at the Rochester Convention Center when the High Lama came, we had prayer flags across the Genesee River, across Main Street, this five-day affair. Big success, but Bill got Frontier to loan us, provide us with mobile phones to help in our organizing because it's a spread-out kind of activity. Of course, these were like from World War II or MASH, you know, the big, heavy, clunky things.
Frank, I got to jump in early because our guests are going to be out of time, and I appreciate that. The stories you're sharing, by the way, I don't think anybody here is surprised by. Bill was a worldly guy, yes. And that says nothing about any of the allegations against him. Was he not a worldly, well-traveled?
That's exactly Bill Nojay, what this story describes. That's him.
Yeah, I think that's well said. Let me do this here. Guys, can you stay for about three more minutes? Let's get our only break of the hour. I've got one more call I want to take, and that's Marie in Pittsford. I know she wanted to weigh in as well. Then we'll let the reporters go, and we're going to talk suicide prevention as well, all in regards to the tragic death of Bill Nojay and some of these allegations that were out there against him. So let's get our only break and come right back here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the summer of food continues with a discussion on craft beer and selling out. If a craft brewery is bought by a big corporate parent like Anheuser-Busch, is that evidence that the beer will never be the same? That it's sold out? That you should spend your dollars elsewhere? Or is that just a good business decision? Can the beer remain the same, even with a big corporate parent? We'll discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Gary Craig and Steve Orr from the Democrat and Chronicle are here, and they broke the story on Friday about the pending court appearance and fraud charge that Mr. Bill Nojay could have been facing. And so we've asked them to stay for just a couple more minutes as we get to the last of your questions, and this is Marie in Pittsford next up. Go ahead, Marie.
I think it's important that you continue investigating this to alert others in the community who may have been Nojay's clients that they should maybe be on the alert to look at their own accounts. I mean, whether he's guilty of this or not, at least they could be aware of some of the things that were going on and look at their accounts and their past interactions with him for any kind of untoward activities. Thanks.
Marie, thanks very much here. Just some general thoughts there.
She makes a very good point. I mean, there's probably multiple reasons, as we've talked about here, why we should continue to pursue this. And I admit, I hadn't even thought about that one, but I think she makes a really good point as to another reason why we should.
Okay, and one more pushback then on the other side of that coin. On Twitter, Misty and Jenna say, well, Misty says, why the urgency to unseal these records? He's not yet been buried. And the charges would have no defense. In other words, you know, if you bring this out, he can't stand up in public and say, here's the response, here's where maybe they've got it wrong. And so Jenna says exactly no reason to unseal.
Well, that's actually, they kind of hit the nail on the head of the people who say there is legal reason not to unseal it. I will try to get into the doctrine of abatement because I still don't understand it, but having talked about it to people yesterday, but there is this sort of legal doctrine of abatement, which basically the person is deceased. They do not have the opportunity to defend themselves. And that's what a number of people are pointing to, a number of attorneys saying, here's why the record should not be unsealed.
And so that's why that doctrine of abatement could be the grounds for why we don't end up seeing
that. Well, maybe.
Okay. So, Gary and Steve, I want to thank you for your time on this. You can follow their work, democratandchronicle.com, or, of course, I know, listeners, you've got a Democrat and Chronicle subscription. You'll see the work every morning. But if anybody missed it earlier, Gary and Steve, what do you think the next step here is what?
Well, next step will be waiting to see if the complaint is unsealed. As Gary said, if we're lucky, maybe the end of the week we'll know. And beyond that, for us, it will be continuing to make some inquiries here and there with sources and other places, documents, to try and if we can learn more about what Mr. Nojay might have been involved with.
Thank you both for your work
on
this subject and many others. And thanks for coming in and educating our listeners on it. We'll let you guys go here. Gary Craig and Steve Orr from the Democrat and Chronicle as they hustle back to their work, wherever they're going. Office, wherever it is. Not mowing the lawn, I assume, Steve Orr. Not today. Pizza stop. That's always a good place to go. I want to turn the attention, and we're going to stay on the story of Bill Nojay's death, but I want to turn the attention now in a very different direction, and that is the question of suicide prevention. And I want to bring in Christina Mosgraber, who is events coordinator with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and the Rochester chapter. And Christina, first of all, I know we've talked on the subject of mental illness and suicide prevention in the past. It's nice to see you back here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I am not. And I want to just clarify this and sort of state the obvious, but this is important. Christina's not here to weigh in on any legal matters or any political matters. But I do think, no matter where you stand politically, whether you knew Bill Nogier or not, this is a very sad story, is it not?
It is. It's anytime there's a suicide, it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy for the loss of the life of the person, for the families, for the friends, for the ripple effect that it has with their loved ones and within the community. And I think that, you know, one thing I'd like to say about that is that if we can work really hard to start breaking down the stigma that's surrounded by that, because
sure.
I think sometimes when there's a suicide, people have a lot of misconceptions about it, make a lot of judgment. And something that I hold strongly to is suicide, in my opinion, is when your brain can't take any more pain. Whether it happens over a course of minutes, weeks, days, months, years, your brain can't find another way out than ending your own life.
Yeah, and as I said in our first half hour, we may never know, and I'm sure we'll never know exactly what was going on with Bill mm-hmm. Nogier's mindset. What led him to make that choice on Friday morning. But what I do know is this, Christina. I have seen a number of people in online settings speculating or even, I think, downplaying, I don't even know if downplaying is the right word, almost minimizing mm-hmm. the way they describe this kind of suicide. And I've never mm-hmm. thought about it like this, but I've heard people say, look, suicide for people who have mental illness is a tragedy. For people who are escaping problems is a weakness. I heard somebody say that. I saw that in multiple places online. I thought, I can't, you know, they just put two categories into it. And one is sort of legitimized and one is minimized. And I've never heard that. But can we talk a little bit about that? Why people would seek to do that, especially in this case, you know the person involved here. But sometimes things overlap, the reasons people,
absolutely.
Right? Take me through some
yeah.
of that.
Yeah. Well, you know, a fact of this is that 90% of suicide attempt survivors and also people who complete suicide have an underlying mental health condition. That was very true in my case. My mental illness had not been diagnosed.
And you said 90%?
90%.
90%,
yeah,
okay.
90% have an underlying, again, whether it's, you know, longstanding buildup, something that has presented, but 90% of people have an underlying mental health condition.
Okay.
You know, and again, like we've talked about, any suicide is a tragedy, you know, however it happens. And I do think there's misconception out there that suicide is it's weak, it's very selfish. I've heard those things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, from my position, again, as an attempt survivor, I never would have chosen to bring that pain on my friends and family or to get to that point in my life. And in my position, I was very accomplished. I was very successful. And there was a number of triggers that led to that. And I think that, again, you know, someone who completes suicide or attempts can be anyone and everyone. It's not weak. It's, again, you can't find a way out. And I implore people if they could hopefully just take a little bit from that thinking that, you know, it's not a choice. Your brain just doesn't know any other way out.
Okay. And you know, I probably made the wrong construction of words as well when I said he chose to end his life. I know in many schools of thought, it is beyond that point of being a choice.
Yes.
So before we talk a little bit about your story, remind our listeners, I think anytime you've got a high profile suicide like this, let's get past the judgment and let's talk resources. At least we can remind people. You
Absolutely.
Know anyone who's ever been there. You've been there yourself. Whatever the case is, what do you want people to do, Christina?
I want people to start the conversations early and seek help as early as possible. We know that if people seek help earlier, hopefully their outcomes would be much better. In Rochester, we're very fortunate to have many mental health resources. One thing that is really fantastic we have here in Rochester is Lifeline, which is 211. It's a little known secret in a lot of categories, and 211 can actually connect people with the mobile crisis team, with 911, and with the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. So 211, Lifeline, fantastic resource. There is always the National Alliance on Mental Illness. There is the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Mental Health Association. Those are all fantastic resources for learning about it in the early stages. But when someone's in a crisis, especially if it's an imminent crisis where you're concerned someone may be taking their life, it's a medical emergency, and 911 is the answer.
Tell me a little bit about your background then. You said you were doing pretty well professionally, mm-hmm. you know, and what was going on in your life?
Well, at the time, I can say too, a little just quick backstory that mm-hmm. I definitely knew something had been going on for a very long time. I had, looking back on it, a phrase that, you know, I use all the time is we didn't know what we didn't know. And that's how I look at it. I don't have any regrets or anger or anything about anything that happened, but it's important to have these conversations. So to raise awareness about this, because, you know, I've had a lot of people say to me, you're the last person that I ever thought would try to take their life. And what happened in my case was there was a series of events that were huge stressors, very large stressors, and I was declining significantly and didn't know what was happening. And after actually even my first suicide attempt, when I sought help, I was turned away, you know, with that it wasn't that serious, basically.
Wait, so you sought help, were turned away, and then attempted suicide?
Oh, no, this was after my first suicide attempt.
So you attempted suicide.
Correct.
And then sought help, and when you were told it wasn't that serious?
Mm-hmm, I was, yeah.
Oh, wow.
By a physician. So, and then I continued to decline, unfortunately, because there's so much shame associated with, you know, with suicide. And that's something, again, we're trying so hard to break down, the shame that's affiliated with mental illness and suicide and things like that. And so I continued to decline, actually, then made another serious suicide attempt and almost lost my life. And I'm very fortunate that I did not, but I spent a month in the hospital and worked extremely hard to get better. And I'm so proud of the work that, you know, I'm involved with now to raise awareness about suicide prevention and mental health.
I was reading some of the work by Florida State University psychologist Roy Baumeister on this. He wrote a 1990 Psychological Review article called Suicide as Escape from the Self. And he talked about six steps that go into that. And again, to state the obvious here, every person is different. I mean, you can't perfectly diagnose it with a group category. But in this case, he talked about, let me read his on step four, which he called negative affect, saying it may seem to go without saying that suicides tend to be preceded by a period of negative emotions. But in Baumeister's escape model, negative suicidal emotions are experienced as an acute state rather than a prolonged one. Concluding simply that depression causes suicide and leaving it at that may be inadequate for several reasons, he writes. It is abundantly clear that most depressed people do not attempt suicide and that not all suicide attempters are clinically depressed. Anxiety, which can be experienced as guilt, self-blame, threat of social exclusion, ostracism, and worry, seems to be a common strand in the majority of suicides. And he says, humans may very well be the only species for which negative social evaluative appraisals can lead to shame-induced suicide. It's just remarkable. But what he is saying here is that a lot of people think that someone who may be suicidal is that way for days or weeks or months, but often there is a buildup, and then there is a very dangerous period of time where it could happen, and an intervention is absolutely necessary. You tend to agree with that?
I do, very much so. And I agree with all of that statement. And in my case, too, and again, I'm just speaking from my own personal experience, there was so much shame and there was so much anxiety. When I was working through the outpatient treatment in between my two attempts, my original diagnosis was depression. And in my case, my actual diagnosis is bipolar disorder. I was being treated for depression and the medication was making it worse. And I didn't know that. And then again, the shame built and the anxiety and all that. Meanwhile, I was getting sicker. But I think that I think that all those factors, and there is a very dangerous period. It can be days, it can be weeks, it can be months. But I tell people all the time, too, it may be the most awkward conversation you ever have. And you may think that your friend or family member is going to, you know, they're never going to talk to you again. But it may save their life. You know, so if you're concerned about someone, ask the obvious question. Ask the obvious question if they're, you know, thinking about hurting themselves or taking their life.
Sure. And I know one of the temptations we have is to say to someone, think about your friends and family. Think about what this would do to them. Baumeister writes that someone who eventually attempts suicide may go through periods of psychological pain, but they are not ready to attempt suicide because they are thinking about the past, mm-hmm. the present, and the future, all as viable things, whether there's pain associated or not. And they are thinking about what this action, what it would mean for people close to them. The danger is when they start to break from that, to disassociate from, well, the past doesn't matter anymore because I'll be gone and there is no future. And then this notion of, you know, finding a way to block out what this would mean to friends or family. But every person's different. So for you, mm-hmm. your first attempt, mm-hmm. how much were you thinking about friends and family? What do you remember?
I actually remember quite a bit. I do remember that was actually, in my case, the shame had gotten so significant that I actually thought they would be better off without me. That, you know, I had in my head built up that, you know, all these things that I had done, that many of them were not true. They were just things that were manifesting, you know, based on anxiety and underlying symptomology. But I thought my family and friends would be better off without me. And then I thought, you know, if I disclosed all these things that were going on in my mind and the struggles I was having, that the shame, you know, again, the shame of it all was taking over, that I wouldn't be the same person. People wouldn't love me anymore. People wouldn't think I was the same Christina. They would think I was this broken version of myself. Again, all so many reasons to talk about, you know, mental health, because I now know that to be very untrue, very untrue. But at the time, I really did think people would be better off without me. And that broke my heart, but I still felt so strongly that I thought they'd be better off without me.
Sure. And I guess in some ways, once you come to that conclusion, it becomes easier for you to try to perceive with it, because you've got a rationalization that this is actually better for loved ones. Mm-hmm. And let's just stress the point again. You ever thought that yourself, or anyone you know ever says that, there's an easy answer, and that is wrong. That is wrong, wrong, wrong. So did you also, in Baumeister's model, he's talking about sort of saying, I'm going to stop worrying about the past because I'm going to be gone, or I don't have to worry about the future anymore, and that's almost a lifting. Did you think about those things?
Mm-hmm. I did. Actually, the day of my, and this conversation's just on my mind, the day of my second attempt, I was on the phone with a friend of mine, which I don't remember at all.
You don't remember that?
I don't remember that.
Wow.
I don't remember that conversation, and there's a reason, but okay. I don't remember that. And she did tell me, though, that I was the most peaceful and the most content that I'd ever been, because I'd let go of the past and I had, you know, was not worried about the future, and I'd let go of the past. I was in a very, very dangerous position at that time. But I have talked to other people who have been attempt survivors that have experienced that feeling of a kind of a peace and a calm when they've gone that far in their thought process. Mm.
Talking to Christina Mosgraber, who is the events coordinator for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness Rochester chapter, and she's sharing this story. It sounds like I'm probing pretty deeply here, but she's sharing the story because she's a community leader helping people understand what she's gone through and helping prevent that. And I just want to stress again how much I admire you for being willing to share this, and how much good I think you are doing. I have a couple of questions from listeners that I sort of hesitate to go down this path, but let me try to do this generally and again without any sort of disrespect. A couple people heard Assemblyman Bill Nojay the day before his suicide. His suicide was Friday. He completed suicide Friday morning. On Thursday, he was on another radio show talking about running for office, how he wanted people to vote for him this coming Tuesday, mm-hmm. today, it was the most, for lack of a better word, normal-sounding interview. Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of people saying, how can that be possible for someone who's 24 hours away from ending their life? How does that happen? And my answer to that is obviously I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot we have to be careful not to speculate too much. But when you think back to your own situation, you know, 24 hours before your attempt, would you have seemed different to people, do you think?
Some people yes and some people no.
Okay.
Some of the people closest to me, you know, obviously knew I'd been struggling for a while. Some didn't. But as far as, you know, say if I was out in public, you know, at dinner or something, I very easily could have put on, I very easily could have put on the facade that everything was fine. I do remember very distinctly, though, that Sunday morning, it was like a flip switch. I was reviewing some stuff for my job, and something just flipped in my head. And, you know, in Mr. Nojay's case, certainly we will never know, and I don't want to speculate that that's what happened. I can only speak that in my case, I knew I was in a dangerous place, but I didn't realize how dangerous, and something just snapped. And
that was it.
And that was it.
So that Sunday morning of your first attempt, mm-hmm. when you woke up, you did not wake up knowing you were going to attempt suicide.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, so that should be illuminative to people who think, well, how could 24 hours before he seem so, for lack mm-hmm. of a better word, normal? You don't always know.
Right.
Okay, and so you got the diagnosis of depression. I'm not going to mine too deep on that. What else happened? It sounds like there was maybe certain things that might have been mishandled. But your second attempt was how much time later?
My first one was September 7th, and my next one was December 3rd.
December 3rd?
Yeah.
So, wow, okay, just a few months later. And after the second one, mm-hmm. did things finally change for the better?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I certainly can say I wouldn't be here talking to you if they hadn't, which is amazing. And I'm so grateful for everyone who has been a part of that. But I will say, though, that when I woke up in the ICU, it took me a while. I was actually in the hospital for about 2.5 weeks before my mind started to turn around that I wanted to get better. And I, again, I'm so grateful for that. But certainly it didn't happen. Again, a flip didn't switch back over that I was grateful to be alive, which everyone is different. Every single person is different. And that was just how it happened in my case.
Okay. And I also heard you say that people have told you, boy, you seem like the last person I would think would attempt suicide. Mm-hmm. You know, that your career's going well. Things, look at your life. When you hear that, it's well-intended. Does that make it worse anyway? Does that help anyway? I mean, like when people say that, they really want to be saying something great, which is that, you know, things are great in your life, you know?
Yeah.
But what does that do for someone who's attempted suicide?
Well, in my case, I use it as an education opportunity. I use it as an opportunity to explain that you never know what anybody could be struggling with at any time. And again, just I also try to help people understand that it is such a difficult topic. You know, mental illness, especially, you know, it's a brain disorder. It's a brain disease. And, you know, if somebody had a heart attack, you're not going to judge them. But if somebody has a brain attack and attempts suicide, they may be treated very differently, you know. So, I try to help people understand that, and also that, again, you know, ask the questions. You know, ask the questions of if you think somebody might be struggling. Because in my case, you know, a lot of people were concerned but weren't really sure what to say, and that's okay. That's totally okay. Just all the more reason we need to raise awareness, because it may be the last person, you know, that you expect that is in that place.
How long has it been for you? The second attempt in that December.
December 2014. I went home New Year's Eve of 2014. So it's been a year and 8 months, 9 months.
I sort of thought you were going to tell me it's been 5 or 7 years or something.
No, a little under 2 years.
Why? I mean, I'm so impressed with you.
Thanks.
And I think this community is so lucky to have NAMI. So before we lose the hour, then what else is on your mind on this subject that you want our audience to hear about the subject of mental illness, suicide prevention, resources?
Well, again, and I know I've said this, but I certainly just want to implore that it can be anyone and everyone. And mental illness is a medical illness, just like any other medical illness. There are treatments, there are options, you know, and I do recognize the stigma that's associated with it. But we're all working so hard in our field to break down that stigma so that people will seek treatment more readily. In addition to that, earlier is better for treatment. Earlier is better. And if you think something is going on, seek treatment. I encourage you, because I always tell people I would never want to see somebody in the position I got to. If I knew what I knew, like I like to say, you know, I may have had a different course. But now that I'm here, I want to work hard to help other people know about resources again, such as NAMI and Lifeline at 211, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Mental Health Association, a lot of great resources we have here in Rochester.
Jenna on Twitter says, avoiding public conversation about mental illness, suicide, drug use is never the answer. End of the stigma, she says. And to the extent that, I mean, I don't know if 2 years ago, if 3 years ago, 5 years ago, I told you you'd be sitting on a public talk show sharing this kind of story. It might surprise you here. But even in 2 years, even in a year and 8 months for you, what have you seen when it comes to public stigma? Are we doing any better?
I would definitely say that we're doing better, especially one thing that's very I'm very passionate about is the work that's being done in the schools. At NAMI, we have a program that I'm involved with educating middle and high school. It's called Ending the Silence, and we educate middle and high school kids about mental health, mental illness, and suicide prevention. And you know, even 5 years ago, this program wasn't happening in the Rochester area. We just actually started doing it last school year. But it's just so encouraging for me to see. And also in the public, I'm seeing more and more awareness events about mental illness and addiction disorders. So it's very encouraging.
You've got the 15th annual Jessica Henderson Memorial event coming up towards the end of October. You got about 30 seconds. Tell us about it, because I know people can still attend, and this is a great opportunity to support this kind of cause and this kind of help. Tell us real briefly.
Absolutely. The Jessica Henderson Memorial event was started in memory of a young woman who lost her life to mental illness. This year, we are thrilled to be bringing in Shamiqua Holdsclaw, who is a former WNBA player, Olympic gold medalist, and
awesome.
A very fierce mental health advocate. After her own struggles, were very, very public. And we are going to have just a lot of great components to the event. We're very excited about it. It is October 25th. You can visit namirock.org to buy tickets.
NAMIROC.org to get tickets.
Absolutely. Or call 585-423-1593. That's the NAMI Rochester office, which you can call for tickets or help or anything you need.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Congratulations on your continued success
and
the work that your organization does in this community. Our thanks to Gary Craig and Steve Orr as well from the Democrat and Chronicle. Short break, more connections next.